Well, I thought Gary was going to also remind you to get your luggage tags. I'd like to begin by just reiterating some of the words of thanks that Gary gave to so many. I won't go into the same detail, but any of you who have organized conferences like this know how much work it takes, and we're just so thankful for all those who have been involved. And I have to say, I count it one of the great privileges of my life to be involved with many of you and with the people on our team that do so much here. I do want to underline how appreciative we are of your taking the time to come here. We know many of you, many we've known for a long time. We know how busy you are. We know what it means to come this far. I do it often enough that I really know how far it is. So we're really very grateful. I believe we've had a particularly remarkable conference this year, starting with the plenary session Sunday evening and coming down to the most recent round of regional breakout sessions. We've really had a remarkable symposium. I think the significance of the issues is underscored by the fact that we were addressed this year by both the United States Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Susan Johnson Cook, who heads the Office of International Religious Freedom in the United States Department of State, and the chair of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, Dr. Katrina Sweat. I have to tell you that for the past few years, these two institutions have been having somewhat of a feud, and it's nice to see them on a new and even keel working together. It's a healthy feud, I should say, because one of the problems with religious freedom is that it practically always shows up on the agendas of different human rights workers, of different government officials. But it always slips down the agenda. And there are some reasons that it should. It does come behind people who are being tortured, their lives being threatened, other kinds of really egregious human rights violations. But one of the difficulties is that if attention is not paid to freedom of religion or belief, that is a simmering issue that can cause other kinds of problems. And actually, the creation over a decade ago now of the U.S. Institutions, the International Religious Freedom Office in the State Department and the Commission, was designed in part to make sure that there would be an institution somewhere within the U.S. foreign policy establishment to make sure this didn't slip to the bottom of agendas. And one of the impressive things is we're now seeing the proliferation of institutions like this in the European Union, in Canada, in a number of other places around the world. So at the beginning, I'd like to just sort of highlight the symbolic significance of having the two of them here and thinking about the symbolic significance of really taking this issue seriously. For far too long, those running foreign policy in the nations of the earth have tended to think of religion as a factor that could or should be neglected in the world of realpolitik. But nations around the world are increasingly realizing that this is an issue that is neglected at their peril. Where the elites running foreign policy, whether they're the elites' foreign policy are believers themselves or not, one simply cannot understand the world we're living in without understanding the role that religion plays in human life. Now, I want to, in a way, begin not by stressing the problems we've discussed, which are, of course, legion, and not merely by underscoring the importance of the issues, but by talking as Professor Ravitch suggested, about building bridges, perhaps about building reservoirs as well. Sometimes dams that create reservoirs, such as Hoover Dam on the Colorado River or Deer Creek Reservoir that's up Provo Canyon here, sometimes they're They both make the reservoir and are the bridge. One of the powerful images, I thought, coming from our third plenary session today was the Venerable Jinhua Li's image of Dharma, which means law, justice, and the ideal. And he said that Dharma signifies natural reality like flowing water. It will eventually overcome obstacles. The nature of Dharma is harmonious and non-dual. It is adaptable and peaceful. I'm sure he could elaborate on this in much greater detail. I got the image and the metaphor. The idea of Dharma, as I understand it, has links to other religious traditions, to natural law, to the Tao and Taoism, to fundamental truths in other systems. Similarly, the Arabic word Sharia originally referred to a waterway that leads to a main source of water. Now, the image is of a substance that is life-giving, gentle, and yet inexorable. And then we were reminded by our, I think I've got the right person, our Colombia delegate, Maria Patricia Ariza Velasco. She asked the question, how this gentle source of life can also be terribly destructive. It can come in the form of tsunamis. Now, or perhaps take another image. I don't want to make you nervous, but Provo is located in a valley below two reservoirs. My wife's uncle didn't want them to build the second reservoir, the Jordanelle, because he was convinced it would collapse and wipe out. He was more concerned about Heber City, but Provo would be second on the list. So these reservoirs store winter runoff water so that we'll be able to live and survive what is otherwise a desert environment. We can't live without the water of these reservoirs. Generally, the water is released in gradual streams. We call them rivers in Utah. I realize the others of you would laugh at what we call a river, these streams have really helped make the desert blossom as a rose. If the dams creating these reservoirs were to collapse, they would unleash terrible devastation. Now, as I understood the question from our Colombian friend this morning, it was not just about the relationship of religion to physical ecosystems, but about what happens when ideological, cultural, and political tsunamis are let loose, sweeping away the normal structures of life with violence, social disintegration, and conflict. Are there things we can do as ordinary human beings when faced with those kinds of tides? I think there are there things that we can do when entire political systems start to shift, or when we see tides in political affairs or social trends. I've spent a good deal of time over the past couple of years just thinking about the kinds of forces that are chipping away at freedom of religion or belief, and there's really a confluence of a lot of different things. We talk about secularization, there are a lot of different trends in society, and in interesting and frightening ways, these come together to erode some of the most fundamental constitutional structures that we've developed over the past couple of centuries. Now, the question is, are there things that we can do to build bridges or to build reservoirs that may be able to withstand these kind of tsunamis or, when necessary, to recover from them? The conference opened with the profound reflections of Professor Silvio Ferrari, who received our Distinguished Service Award this year. He focused on this question about, he didn't really talk about reservoirs and bridges exactly, but He focused on this question in the context of Abrahamic religions. He described how the notion of natural law, accessible to reason in the Christian tradition, helped pave the way for creation of secular states as we have known them in the West. They've enabled us to build social structures that can accommodate people of different beliefs and allow them to live in peace together. The fact that functional equivalents to natural law are much narrower in Judaism and perhaps thin to the vanishing point in Islam, justifying only millet systems where people of the book can follow their personal law, these differences create differences in different societies. According to Professor Ferrari's analysis, and I quote, "The secular state is not a religiously neutral construct. Its origin is connected to Christian theological concepts," unquote. This leads to two problems. Whether the secular state is a model that can be exported beyond the Christian West, can it be a viable type of state for the Arab countries of the Mediterranean following the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening? Even more fundamentally, Professor Ferrari asked, does the secular state still answer the needs even of the West in our highly pluralized, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, and multicultural world? These questions align with the fundamental questions we were hoping would be asked at the conference. Can we use what have become the classical tools of modern states to build bridges and build the reservoirs that we need? Will freedom of religion and enjoyment of civil and political beliefs on an equal basis, regardless of religion, and these are the key tools that have served us well over two centuries in the United States and for shorter periods but extensive periods in other countries, will these continue to work in our altered landscape? Professor Ferrari's conclusion appears at first to be rather pessimistic. Quote, "The secular state is inextricably linked to Christianity, and it is futile to attempt to export the Western model of secular state to regions of the world that do not meet the conditions for accepting it," unquote. For example, he thinks, and again, quote, "It is an exercise in wishful thinking to believe that the idea of the secular state can easily take root in the Muslim East." But the analysis is not totally without hope. He says, rather than trying risky legal transplants, it's preferable for each civilization to look within its own religious and cultural tradition for the suitable tools to address the problem of freedom of religion and equal enjoyment of civil, political, and political rights. The hope, as I understand it, lies in two considerations. First, the great religious traditions of our world all have tools for building bridges and reservoirs, for fostering the mutual respect and understanding that makes possible a common life in our highly pluralized but shared world. Second, the idea of the secular state can be interpreted not as a form of society that is hostile to religion, or at least drives it into the private sector, but it can be interpreted more flexibly so that it provides an adaptable common framework within which citizens holding a variety of religious and non-religious views can coexist in peace. One of the key kinds of reservoirs that needs to be built are states, which Roman Catholic leaders refer to as healthy secularity, states which are open to and accommodating of different forms of belief, including non-belief, but do not become a tool of ideology, what you might call an ideology of secularism. It's one thing to have a secular state that is open and embracing and welcoming of other of religious groups, and another that is sort of tries to further itself as an end in itself. That is, in that sense, the secular state starts becoming hostile to religion. And what is one of the critical structures of the state itself, the reservoir needs to be built in a way that it's open, accommodating, and flexible. In the opening plenary session Monday, we had an excellent discussion focused in part on the Arab Awakening, but thanks to Senator von Weisterfeld, that included as well how parallel themes are playing out in Europe. And I had thought this was, in a way, a really useful thing because they reflected on broad issues that we're seeing in dramatic settings right now in the Middle East, but also that have relevance to the broader, the kind of world, the leading democratic societies and so forth. One theme that emerged is that the secularization of religion or the secularization thesis is dead or dying. Theorists who have been assuming that religion would wither away in our post-industrial age are finding instead that the secularization thesis itself is withering away. Moreover, we are seeing that it is referred to, we're seeing a pattern of desecularization. There have been a number of books written about this, about the resurgence of religion in the public square. And so we're seeing a number of significant transitions. Now, we focused on transitions in the context of the Arab Spring, and where we're seeing those transitions occur, religion is clearly playing a role. It's not clear what the transitions are to yet, and it's not clear exactly how these roles are, what role religion will ultimately play. There are current developments that are leading us to raise new questions and see new issues in the relationship of democracy and religion. What Senator von Weisterfeld saw in the Dutch situation are realities we recognize in other parts of the world. Democracy finds it difficult to deal with the unmanageable, the uncontrollable, the unfamiliar, and the uncompromising. In each of these areas, religion challenges democracy. And yet at the same time, religion has profound contributions to make to democracy. It provides both utopian vision and dystopian anthropology, by which I mean it reminds us that we're not perfect, and far from it. And perhaps more important than either of those two contributions, it helps to generate the altruism and the commitment and the faith that keep humans striving to develop new visions of utopia or new directions that we can move in, and that this striving itself is vital. In a certain sense, democracy without that kind of striving just becomes a chaos of self-interest, of material interests, and so forth. We need impulses that drive us to seek the best in us. Moreover, religion helps to build and protect the institutional reservoirs that engender the vision, the motivation, and moral support that translate religious and moral ideals into personal and communal practice. Reflecting on the issues raised by the current events of the Arab Awakening and the broad ferment in other areas of the world reminded me of a statement made by the great German constitutionalist and jurist Wolfgang Buchenfurter. I looked for it this afternoon but ran out of time, so I'm sure I don't have it exactly right. But this is the idea. Constitutions are incapable of guaranteeing the conditions that they presuppose. That is, constitutional governments, as we've come to understand it, presuppose some things about human life and human society. They presuppose that family institutions work. They presuppose that there are certain kinds of shared understandings. There are a variety of things, and I think this is something that has been a background theme running through a number of the discussions. We live in a constitutional age. Virtually every country today has a constitution, usually a written one. The UK still has unwritten, and there may be a few others in that category, but even unwritten constitutions, by the way, are really just a collection of written things that are around over time, somewhat unwritten. But these presuppose institutions like the family, religious belief, honesty and integrity, what our founders called public virtue, that is the willingness to sacrifice for the public good. The plenary sessions yesterday afternoon and this morning, I think, gave us additional insight into the relationship of religion, civil society, and pluralism. Alan Hertzky spoke about the paradox of government and civil society, which is essentially that when governments see tensions involving religion, the impulse is to regulate more, but in fact this may be counterproductive. Sometimes it's necessary, but more often it increases the likelihood that there will be instability, there will be resentment, there will be things that cause greater problems. This tendency to overregulate is a kind of creeping phenomenon associated with the welfare state, but it's resulting in a world in which 70% or more of the population on Earth lives under high or very high restrictions, and the restrictions in many ways are mounting. Yet the irony is that the best current empirical evidence, and I have to say that the current empirical evidence basically vindicates about two centuries of political theory going back to Adam Smith and John Locke and others, but it makes it clear that it's often counterproductive to overregulate religion. And I think one of our hopes is that we can contribute in some ways to disseminating this information. It really makes a profound policy difference if you understand, as a someone involved in religion policy, that when you see the instinctive response, you see a problem, we need to regulate that. And the research shows you've got to be careful, because very often that will just make it worse. And that's a very practical insight that needs to be better understood. Imposing constraints on people that discriminate against them requires them to violate their conscience can easily become a source of social instability or even violence. Hertzky reminded us of the twin tolerations, the notion that the state allows religious organizations to operate freely in society, provided that they in turn tolerate others and renounce the use of state powers to enforce their beliefs. The empirical data provides strong reasons for thinking that protection of religious freedom helps to protect and generate social capital, thereby advancing other social goods. Ram Kanan, he told us that he could go on for 5 hours, and believe me, I've read the other books. It's a lot more than 5 hours, and it's a number of books were recommended. I really stumbled upon those last spring, and they're very helpful. What we've known for a long time, that religion cultivates altruism, people who are religiously active contribute more both monetarily and in terms of volunteer service in society. Part of what his work points out is that this isn't automatic. Part of it happens because we have these small little reservoirs, congregations, where people come together, hear teachings, reinforce teachings, and ask each other to do things. And it's in those small reservoir areas that the transformation of the ideas into practice very often happens. These are thus very critical social institutions. Kanan's work is really interesting because it just shows, and you had the sense yesterday, it was almost like he was saying, I'm really sorry to admit this, but these congregations are a powerful social force, and they work well, and they make a huge difference to society. We also had yesterday afternoon, I see I'm running out of time, so I'm going to cut a little bit, but we had this reinforced from another angle from Senator Torfs, who those of us who have known him for a long time treasure his wry humor, but if you sort of get a lot beyond smiling a bit, you realize you said some very profound things about the importance of the autonomy of religious institutions that reinforces the congregational idea of Ram Kanan's work, and so on. Now, this morning, then, we had the piece from Senator Salazar Cruz, among other things, and this has been talked about by others, highlighting the critical preconditions of constitutional society, one in particular, the family. Certainly in this audience, there is a lot of sympathy for that. And while this is not the modality for doing a declaration, I think many would be sympathetic with that. There would be questions from some, and so this is part of having the views and enlightening each other. I wanted to also mention, though, another thing that I thought about. Remember in Secretary General Kildani's speech, he picked up on the themes of the conference, religion, democracy, and civil society, and then he said, you also have to think about the land. And he, of course, was talking about this in the most sort of high-stakes, high-tension area where this arises on Earth, that is Palestine, Israel. But in a sense, this comes back in a lot of different forms. If we want to build the reservoirs, make the space for congregations, you need a place where people can meet. Now, you saw on the map all the places in Philadelphia where apparently people can meet. But in a lot of countries on Earth, this is one of the very hard problems. One of the things that the 1981 Declaration on Freedom, 1981 Declaration, I'm going to save time. It's the definitive UN Declaration on this. One of the things it stresses when it gets to Article 6, which goes through the specifics, is that groups should have the right to have a place to worship. Now, this doesn't mean that religious groups can build just anywhere, but excluding groups from a city or a state or something like that, this is a serious problem. Part of how we build the reservoirs is respecting things in a practical way that make it possible for people to meet, to worship as they feel fit, and not just worship, do the other kinds of social capital generating things that religious communities and congregations do. Let me just come to a conclusion. How do we build the bridges and the reservoirs? Religious liberty is a powerful tool that has evolved and emerged in most countries on Earth now have committed themselves to this, both through their constitutions and through international human rights instruments. One of the challenges is that this right, people don't necessarily attack the right itself. It gets chipped away by exception, and we're seeing more and more exceptions emerging. But this is a powerful tool for building the reservoirs, providing the protections, building some of the bridges. These remain fragile structures. Again, as Professor Ravitch said, they can easily be swept away. But it is in settings like this, with people who really know and care about these issues, that we can build bridges, that we can come to understand each other, that some of our inevitable prejudices, prejudice in a way just means we've prejudged things that we don't yet know enough about, those we can work away at those, and as we come to know other people of goodwill, we start developing the most critical tool of all, which is respect. That allows us to build bridges. Another image, I like the image, and I can't remember which of the speakers this afternoon said it. They talked about being sort of feeling interwoven. It's more than just a bridge, that we feel connected. I think one of the things that we truly hope comes out of this kind of conference is that it is not just something that concludes, but it is a beginning that we have ongoing, that we do build ongoing networks, tapestries, bridges, and so forth. Let me conclude with just one other thing, and this is one other thought I had listening to the Venerable Jinhua Li. He reminded us that while there may be such a thing as an ex-spouse, there is no such thing as an ex-father or an ex-mother. And in a similar way, it seems to me, there is no such thing as an ex-brother or an ex-sister. And sometimes we have to discover who our brothers and sisters are. Sometimes in events like this, we do that. Certainly, that has been true in my life. I thank you for joining our family here, and we hope that we will avoid becoming ex-brothers and ex-sisters, and that we will have continuing warm relations. Thank you very much.